Would the world be a better place with more nuclear power? That's the question I asked Rachel Slaybar in the following conversation. Rachel was formerly a Berkeley professor, division director at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and a licensed nuclear reactor operator. Now, she's a partner at deep tech venture capital, DCVC, and one of the world's leading experts on the future of nuclear energy. We discuss the fears that many people have surrounding nuclear waste and plant meltdowns. We also cover the economics and environmental benefits of nuclear and discuss the new advanced reactor designs that are coming online right now and which are turning nuclear into a much more exciting, low-carbon prospect. I'm Shane Farnsworth, and this is the Escape Sapiens podcast, supported by the Andrea von Braun Foundation. If you enjoy this content, you can support me directly by liking, subscribing, and sharing. And now, here's Rachel Slaybar. I hope you enjoy.
Escaped Sapiens.
So why does the world need nuclear? What does it give us that wind and solar and other forms of renewables don't or can't?
Yeah, so I view nuclear energy as one of the tools in the toolbox of how you get to a fully clean electricity grid. One of the real benefits of nuclear is that it is what we call a firm power source. So you turn it on, it stays on, you can control how much power it's putting out. So it's very stable. It's also very reliable. And some of the other clean electricity resources we're bringing on are variable, where we can't control when they're on or off. Geothermal is an exception, and I'm excited about geothermal and their clean, firm attributes as well. We can balance renewables with batteries, or variable renewables with batteries, but there's to some extent a limit. And if you have more clean, firm in the system, all of the models indicate it's cheaper, faster, easier to get to a fully decarbonized grid. So that's like one piece. The other piece is we're kind of on the precipice of what we expect to be quite significant electricity growth. The combination of just electrify everything, switching to EVs, from gas furnaces to heat pumps, you know, a lot of electrifying in how do we get to a fully clean system, combined with the growth of like AI and data centers. So we're really staring down really significant growth in electricity. And I think we're kind of at that you just have to build everything you can level of need.
So what I'd like to do ultimately to give you an overview is I'd like to ask you about the new developments that are coming online in the next few years. But before getting to that point, I know that many people in my audience, maybe even the majority, will have issues with nuclear power. So they'll either think it's too dangerous, or they'll think it's economically not viable, or they'll be worried about waste, which has long-term consequences. So I want to touch on those and then eventually get into some of the new exciting things that are happening in the field. So to kick it off, let's start with the fear, right? So is the fear about the danger of nuclear power overblown?
I mean, so there are a couple layers here where the way that people feel, it sort of doesn't matter if it's overblown or not. You have to respect that's how people feel. Humans are exceptionally poor at risk perception, and the kinds of risks associated with nuclear power trigger all of the things that people are worst at perceiving. So even though by the numbers, nuclear is by far the safest power source that we have, you can Google it, safest source of electricity, it's nuclear energy. It sort of doesn't matter because the kinds of accidents feel so scary to people. So even though very few people have ever been killed by nuclear power, the accidents, you know, people don't understand them very well. They're big, they're in the news. So even an accident like Three Mile Island, where no one was harmed by radiation, it felt very scary. People had to evacuate. And so while I think it's okay to keep building nuclear reactors, all of the new designs have higher safety properties, even the new. So we'll talk, I think, about different reactor types. the light water reactors that we've been building, the newer designs still have enhanced safety features. And so I think that's good, not because the reactors actually need to be safer, but because they feel so scary to people and there's such a reaction that we have to respect that piece. And so it's really about how can we make them at a level where it just feels okay to people and still have them be economically viable.
So then if we're not good at risk perception when it comes to something like radiation, which we can't see, what are the actual numbers? How does the risk profile of a plant actually stack up against, for example, coal or wind farms?
Yeah, so coal, I mean, coal kills so many people, especially because of the mining and the air pollution. There are some good diagrams. I wish I had one on hand to have the exact numbers.
We can put it up afterwards in person.
Yeah. Yeah. So coal is by far the most dangerous, followed by natural gas, because go figure, like flammable substances are also pretty dangerous. Nuclear and wind are the closest. They're about the same safety level, where in wind, the accidents are like people, you know, there's just accidents in installation. And solar is slightly more dangerous because of residential and people fall off roofs. Which is like, it feels a little funny, but it's not great. But like, you don't read in the news about like somebody fell off a windmill. Like, it just isn't.
Right. But when it comes to nuclear disasters, it does make the news because they're larger. So people will probably remember, the older members of the audience will remember Chernobyl potentially. And just a few years ago, we had Fukushima. So what was it that went wrong in those cases? And how should we weigh the risks of a meltdown when it comes to future development of nuclear?
Yeah. And all three of the commercial accidents that have happened they're in fairly different categories. So Chernobyl is really its own specific case, where there was a reactor design that was not good. Reactor designs inherently have what we call a negative feedback effect. So we design them so that if the temperature increases because the power went up, the reactor will have an effect that it shuts itself down a little bit, so that you can't have a runaway power effect because of the inherent physics in the reactor system. The Chernobyl power plant did not have that. It had a positive feedback effect, so that a power increase would cause a power increase.
Why was that? That was part of the design? Was it intentional?
I think it wasn't a goal, but I think it was because of a cost, cheap materials, and there was the idea that they could control it. Right. We're talking about the former Soviet Union. There were some real issues there in terms of a cost and bravado, perhaps you could say. And so that design had some instability. You also had reactor operators who were not properly trained. They were operating the reactor, doing an experiment. They deviated from the experimental procedure. It was the weekend before a holiday, or it was the week before a holiday. So there was a little bit of like, people are getting ready to go. To deviate from their experimental procedure, they had to turn off a bunch of safety systems. And so they ended up in an operational situation for which the reactor was not designed. And then the people were not prepared and something went wrong. And so this is kind of an example of, if you really try, you can break anything. And then after there was an accident, they didn't evacuate the surrounding community for days, right? Mm-hmm. So there's like a lot of things that added up to make that accident, you know, tragic. And the total number of people who died as a result of, you know, radiation following, eventual cancers, was still in the like thousands number, which is fewer people than die from coal in a year, every year. And so, right, not to trivialize that accident, like that was a big deal. A lot of things went wrong. So what we have done is reactors with that inherent instability are no longer allowed. All reactors of that type have been shut down. And as a global community, we have said every reactor has to have this fundamental stability, so you can't have a Chernobyl type of reactor. One more thing I forgot to add to that. I mean, there's a long list of like what happened to Chernobyl and why. It didn't have a containment building. It was sort of just in a warehouse. So a containment building, as indicated in the name, is designed to contain an accident. And so Chernobyl didn't have one of those.
Mm. So when it comes to newer designs, then in the case of Fukushima, did that have the new safety features built in? And could it have been worse? Could it have ended up in a full meltdown in the way that Chernobyl did?
Yeah, so Chernobyl was in combination with the meltdown. The excursion happened so quickly. There was a steam explosion that blew the ceiling off the reactor. So there was a lot going on there. So Fukushima did have a containment building and a difference, a key difference in these accidents. So Chernobyl happened very, very fast. There was a quick reaction. A lot of heat was generated. A steam explosion happened. The lid blew off. In Fukushima, because it did have a stable design, a containment building, a lot of safety systems, the accident evolved much more slowly. And so that meant there was, you know, a lot of things still went wrong in Fukushima, but people were not harmed by the radiation. The people who died as a result of the Fukushima nuclear accident died because of the evacuation, actually. No one was harmed because of the radiation. And because of that slowly evolving nature of the accident, that's part of why that was true. An order of magnitude more people died actually from the tsunami. Again, not to trivialize, but just to put in context. And actually, the result of that, like the deaths were from the evacuation, caused some countries to actually revisit their evacuation policies. About when and why should you evacuate in a nuclear accident. So certainly things went wrong in Fukushima, but the slow evolving nature allowed more coping, more people to leave. And it was an older reactor design inside of a pretty significant natural disaster.
Hmm. What would have happened? So if I remember correctly, on the day or when the accident occurred, the wind was blowing away from Tokyo, right? If I understand correctly, could it have been worse? What could have been the worst case scenario, let's say, if the wind had been blowing, if the fallout had gone across Tokyo?
Yeah, again, the on that first day, there wasn't much radiation release. And this is where it's been a while since this accident. I don't know the answer to what the worst case could have been. There's no similarity to Chernobyl. And just as there are a bunch of things that could have made Fukushima go better. But yeah, I don't know that I even have the analysis of like the hypotheticals of if the wind had been different. I'm sure they're out there. It's not what I studied.
Yeah. So one thing that you would have, you will have studied a little bit better though, is when it comes to actually building a reactor, can you build a reactor that is just, so you've mentioned first the feedback loops, right? These positive feedback loops. Can you build a reactor which is inherently safe, or is there a fuel or a reactor design that simply can't go critical? You cannot have a meltdown.
Yeah. So a couple of things. First, critical, because sometimes we're bad at naming things, actually means the reactor is operating at steady state. So if a reactor goes critical, that's how it's supposed to be.
So that's a normal. Good thing.
That's like steady on. unfortunately, misused in the media quite a bit. We can build reactors that are more resilient, and we can build reactors that cannot melt down. So a lot of the new advanced reactor designs cannot melt down. Even the improved light water reactor designs are much more resilient. And I will say, like, even though Fukushima, like, it melted down, right? Like, it was a bad accident. Radiation was released. And yet, no people were harmed by radiation, right? And so for some, the intensity of the Fukushima accident and how low of impact it actually was on people was an example of nuclear safety working. I think, again, this, like, why are people afraid of nuclear? Well, they had to evacuate. It was like a while till they could go back. Like, that was a major economic impact and psychological impact. And so for me, the, even though, you know, you can say, like, well, people, you know, people weren't harmed by radiation. Like, they were harmed by the stress, right? Mm-hmm. There was economic damage. And yeah, so
one,
I
one
think
of my,
those
one
are
of my
things, just the, to complete the thought, like, that's why I think these new designs that have more robust safety features are helpful.
I have a very good friend, and her family is from the area. And she was explaining, I was talking to her before this interview, and she was explaining how in the days after the accident, her family were sort of, they weren't able to escape, and they're, from where they were, they didn't know what was happening. And I think it was the uncertainty that really was most stressful at the time, because radiation is invisible. They didn't know, am I currently safe? What's actually happening? And I think that that is very stressful. But in the end, that didn't actually harm them in any way.
Yeah, that's right. And I think maybe a way to frame how that feels is, now we all went through COVID, right? Where at the beginning, it was really scary. It was really uncertain. We couldn't see it. You don't know when you're coming into contact with it. You don't know, like, when can you go outside? When is it safe? Who can I see? Like, there was, it's not, it's certainly not the same, but just to try to understand some of that impact of the uncertainty and fear and what that looks like, is like, we have a little bit of a glimpse into it from that early days of COVID.
So let's jump onto the next worry that people have, and that is the waste, right? People worry that there's this waste that is going to be around for thousands of years. Could you give me some idea of the waste profile of a plant? By which I mean, I imagine when you have waste coming out of a plant, it's not just the spent fuel, but also maybe the surrounding concrete, things like this. It, from the beginning to the end of the life of a plant, how does it compare, and how do you weigh up the waste against, for example, a coal-fired plant or something more traditional?
Yeah, it's minuscule. Nuclear is the most efficient in terms of resource utilization on fuel compared to things that take fuel, on concrete, on critical materials. It actually uses the least of everything compared to every other energy source. And I kind of didn't bring this up earlier because I knew we were going to bring this now. But part of what's compelling about nuclear in a world of large demand growth is it requires less stuff of every type of stuff. So that's less mining, less transportation of mined materials, less processing. So that whole supply chain consideration around impact, nuclear just needs less. And the sort of second level, the waste that is non-fuel waste, there's actually not that much of that, in part because of shielding. So there's some consideration there, but not a lot. The fuel is mostly what people worry about, and that's the big thing that we need to be careful with. And again, there's a couple of dimensions here. So one is level setting on quantity. So if you live in the United States, and we consume quite a bit of electricity per capita, if you get all of your energy from your whole life, on average, all of that electricity comes from nuclear, the waste you are responsible for at the end of your life takes up half a soda can. It's like,
and what is it for coal? Do you have those numbers?
Oh God, it's
as
like,
well,
piles and piles. So like one nuclear pellet that's the size of the last knuckle of your pinky. I know you can't see it, but just imagine that last little bit. That produces the same amount of electricity as one ton of coal or three barrels of oil.
Right. So one aspect that I've wanted to understand better when it comes to waste is why is it that the waste material is worse than the fuel itself? So what I mean by that is you have to dig up some radioactive material from the ground, you put it through a process, and on the other end, the output, you get some radioactive material. So why are we worried about the radioactive waste, but not about the fuel itself, which we dig up?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's because of the magic of what is actually happening in fission. So uranium, the material we use the most in fission, itself is a little bit radioactive, but mostly it's not. It's emitting radiation at a very low level. So you can hold uranium safely, and that's fine. It's like you wouldn't want to eat it because it's a heavy metal. It's fine from a radiation perspective. But what happens in fission is that you're taking a uranium atom, which is large and heavy and unstable. You add a neutron to it, and that neutron adds enough energy to that unstable uranium atom that it has so much energy, it splits into two pieces. It can't hold itself together anymore. And the things that it splits into are radioactive. And so that process of splitting has a distribution of what it turns into. It turns into a whole collection of atoms, and there's a statistical distribution of what that makeup is. But part of why nuclear waste is complex is because you get all this stuff out of it, and all that stuff is radioactive. And then where the energy is coming from, and this is why I think people got into fission, it's like super cool. So a little bit of mass in that heavy atom gets converted into energy. So that equation, E equals MC squared, that Einstein came up with, that we've all heard about, that's what's happening. That energy is equal to mass times the speed of light squared. So the speed of light is a very big number. When you square it, it's an even bigger number. When you multiply it by a really little bit of mass, you get a lot of energy. So you have this very small mass change. You get a bunch of energy and two new atoms, mostly that are radioactive.
Right. And so it's the quantity, because you're splitting and getting more radioactive substance out, and also the character of the radioactivity may be different.
That's right. And so there are different types of radiation, and there are different durations of radioactive material. So if something is what we would call very radioactive, means it's emitting radiation very rapidly. So it's like, we call it hot. The intensity of radiation is high, so you need to be very careful. The thing is, there's only so much like radiation that's going to be emitted. So when something is emitting radiation very quickly, it is decaying quickly as well. So it quickly becomes much less radioactive. So the stuff that is most intense goes away the fastest. So part of what makes spent fuel manageable over time is at the beginning, it's like very radioactive, but all that stuff that is the very radioactive part kind of decays away. And then what's left in the end is still radioactive, and we need to be careful with it, but it's much less intense. And so the things that are radioactive for the longest are the least intensely radioactive. And so after an initial cooling period, then we can put it into canisters, then we can dispose of it underground if we want to do a once through, which is once through means we take the fuel out of the reactor, we put it in canisters, we bury it underground, that's it, we never use it again.
Is that our best long-term solution for when it comes? What is the half-life of the most worrying component of the waste? So the thing that people are most worried about.
Yeah. So it's difficult. Like, I think what people, the half-life of like, when is it not radioactive anymore, is that's kind of the controlling element where it's the slowest. That's like, you know, tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of years is when nuclear waste isn't radioactive anymore if we don't treat it. There are other materials that drive that cause, you know, the most concern. So one of the things that we can do is recycle nuclear waste, or reprocess is another word you might hear. And that's where we take some of those components that are driving that long-term radioactive signature, we separate them out, and we can actually put them back in a nuclear reactor, expose them to neutrons, get more energy out of them, and convert them into something else so that they're not radioactive for as long. So when we take fuel out of the reactor, we've used between 1% and 5% of the available energy in the fuel. So we can recycle it and get a lot more energy out. And we can also burn up, is what we call it. So we can use as fuel a lot of the things that are radioactive for the most amount of time and the most complex to deal with.
Are we doing that in today's reactors?
We're not. Some countries do what is called a partial recycle, where they take some of that material and reuse it. So France is widely known. Japan has done it. Russia has done it. And there they take the... So when uranium goes into a reactor, some of it turns into plutonium. So they take the uranium and the plutonium that is easy to reuse, and they reuse that part. So that does a lot to decrease the volume and toxicity of the fuel. But a full recycle is when you take out those other materials as well. And this requires, so now we're going to one level deeper in technical complexity. The reactors that we use most of the time today use water as the coolant most of the time, and they're what are called thermal spectrum reactors. Mm. And that means the energy of the neutrons that are causing the fission. So remember, uranium has a fission, goes into it, splits into two pieces, releases energy. That neutron that goes in is relatively low energy. It is called thermal because, again, we are bad at naming things, and it is in thermal energy equilibrium with the surrounding system. There's another category of reactor called fast reactors, and that's where the neutrons stay at higher energy, and so they can interact with more materials and cause them to change. So the low energy neutrons can only interact with certain things easily, and the high energy neutrons can cause more types of things to fission. Mm. And so why we don't call them fast and slow, and instead we call them fast and thermal, not up to me. But to have a fully closed recycling system, you need fast reactors because you need those high energy neutrons to fission and consume the things that are tougher. So maybe to finalize this thought, some of the reactor designs that people are working on are fast reactors. There have been a few in the past. France has operated some commercially. But some of the promise and goal around fast reactors is being able to close the fuel cycle where you can actually more fully recycle the nuclear waste and get rid of all that nasty stuff.
In practice, what is the actual difference when you're designing a fast versus a slow reactor or a thermal reactor?
Yeah, it's a great question. So when, one more piece here. So when the fission happens and it splits into two atoms, more neutrons come out of the split. So the uranium atom makes two new atoms and releases more neutrons. Those neutrons are available to go on and cause more fission. That's how you get a steady state chain reaction where one fission goes on to cause another fission, goes on to cause another fission. When those neutrons are born, they're at pretty high energy. So mm-hmm. neutrons can lose energy or be absorbed pretty easily. So a lot about reactor design is, how are neutrons interacting with material in the system? There's the fuel that you want them to get absorbed into to cause the fission. And then there's everything else, right? There's the coolant, there's any structural materials, all that kind of stuff. So to have a thermal reactor where the neutrons are really slow and they're really good at interacting with uranium-238 at that slow energy, or uranium-235, oh my gosh, sorry. getting ahead of myself. So everybody, uranium-235 is the isotope of uranium that we use the most in fission, and that's what we use in thermal systems. So you bang the neutrons off of sort of materials that are similar in size to it, but not going to absorb it to slow it down. We use water because hydrogen atoms are basically the same size as neutrons. Think of banging a billiard ball off another billiard ball gives up a lot of energy versus banging a billiard ball off of a bowling ball. It doesn't lose much speed.
Because it's just a proton.
Because it's just a proton, neutron. So, or the hydrogen is just a proton, yeah.
Right.
So we slow the atoms down. So in a fast reactor, we remove all the stuff that would slow the atoms down. So then you have a coolant instead of water, you're using a liquid metal like lead or sodium. So for fast reactors, you take out anything that might have a material that would slow neutrons down.
In a thermal system,
we add lots of materials that would slow neutrons down.
I'm still surprised, though. Did I mishear you when you said that it's something like 1% to 5% of the fuel is actually spent before it's waste? That seems really small.
It is. It just, because of the, you know, keeping those neutrons around to cause fission and not get absorbed in something else, it becomes tricky. So once you have those fissioned materials, once you have, like, you just can't keep the reaction going well enough after the fuel is a little bit used.
And it's just economics, which says that it's easier to dig up some more material and process that than to go through
and to recycle.
Yeah, I see. So let's talk about economics. That's the last thing I wanted to ask you about before we can get onto some of the new tech. So people say that, so 10 years ago, something like this, people were saying that nuclear was maybe the cheapest energy per dollar, let's say. But things have changed, right? The solar panel development has come leaps and bounds. We're seeing much cheaper wind generation as well. So how does the economic picture of nuclear power stack up against its competitors, the other renewables?
Yeah, well, so for maybe a let's baseline, nuclear's competitor is natural gas. It is not other renewables. There is like no utility in the country that is thinking about, should I build a nuclear plant or should I build variable renewables? They're all saying, should I build a nuclear plant or should I build natural gas? And the nuclear plants that have been taken offline have been replaced by natural gas, right? Nuclear is not competing with variable renewables. Nuclear is competing with natural gas.
Nonetheless, you still hear people say that solar and wind are cheaper than nuclear these days. Is this not the case?
It's not that it is not the case. It is that that isn't super relevant because of the nature, right? We talked at the beginning about firm power versus variable power. Mm. So if you call up a utility, they are not saying, if I shut down this nuclear plant, am I going to build a solar farm? That's not what's happening. If a nuclear plant gets shut down, it's getting replaced by gas. So it's excellent that wind and solar are cheap. That's great. You need battery backup and their capacity factors are pretty low. So you actually have to build quite a lot of wind and solar to replace a nuclear plant. And their Lazard actually this year or in 2023 maybe started to put out some of those comparison numbers. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, you know, maybe eventually that's the trade-off we're making. But right now that it's not, it's with natural gas. So that's maybe piece one. Piece two is with nuclear cost. It really depends a lot. So existing nuclear plants are incredibly cheap, but that's because all of their capital cost is paid off. So the nuclear electricity that's online right now, very cheap. For new nuclear plants, it depends on where you're building them. So in countries that are good at building large projects, their nuclear plants are cost competitive. So Korea, the Middle East, China, it's a little tougher to tell because it's hard to know the reliability of their numbers. But we're actually building new nuclear power plants quite cost competitively in some countries. The United States, less so, and there's a bunch of reasons about that. So the Vogtle plant that just came online in the United States was quite expensive. Something that somehow there's not a lot of publicity about, and I hope that changes. So they built Vogtle 1. That was the first new design we had built in a really long time. There were a lot of things that weren't done great about that. Vogtle 2 is just about to start putting electricity on the grid. That second one was 30% cheaper than the first one. So it's not cheap enough, but a 30% cost reduction from number one to number two is pretty good, right? And that's like, in general, you need to get to about number four till you're kind of at the learning curve. So there is some evidence that if we kept building those kinds of reactors, they actually would be cost relevant, even in the United States. But the motivation around a lot of the advanced reactor designs is that it will be easier to make them cheap by relying on much more factory manufacturing. The United States is worst in the world at mega projects. We're great at factory manufacturing, right? The San Francisco Bay Bridge, triple budget, triple schedule. Adding radiation does not make that better.
I see. So the idea is you have a new reactor, which is smaller, and so that can bring down capital costs. And then you get the benefit of the operational costs being rather low. Is that the idea?
Yeah. You bring down the actual capital cost per megawatt. And the total capital cost too, right? So these very large reactors are quite expensive, and a lot of utilities don't have the balance sheet even to like get a loan to build them. So if you have a nuclear reactor that is smaller, the total capital cost is lower. More people can get a loan. The loan terms are better. You're now benefiting from manufacturing scale, not construction scale. There's also the idea that, again, I mentioned that if you can make it, if you have less complex engineering to keep a reactor safe, that can reduce cost. So all of these advanced reactor designs, you know, they can't have offsite consequences. So now you don't need an evacuation zone. Your safety systems are less complicated. Some of the cost of reactors is around like guns and guards. So you can also make design choices to reduce how much of that you need, right? There's like all kinds of design choices you can make to lower cost. And that's a big focus of these new reactors.
So then when it comes to sunken costs in capital costs, what do you think of Germany's decision to shut down their reactors?
Yeah, I think maybe everybody outside Germany thinks that was a pretty bad choice. So they have managed to increase their energy prices while missing their emissions targets, right? So what they are doing in variable renewables is great. I'm delighted. The demand of solar in Germany is part of what ultimately brought down the cost of solar. That's excellent. And to shut down their nuclear power plants, they turned back on their coal plants. That seems real questionable to me.
So it sounds like the reason why we're not using more nuclear is political, right? Because from what you're saying, it sounds like the dangers may not be quite what people think they are. The costs are not as much as people think they are, and the waste, it has technical solutions, it sounds like. So what is the reason that we're not using more nuclear? Is it purely political and cultural? What's the reason?
I think it's a combination. So some of it is economic, right? So we could recycle the waste, but it will take more work for that to be economic. And to be honest, like, part of the challenge is uranium isn't that expensive, but also because they're so fuel efficient, the fuel is not that big of a cost. So people aren't economically motivated, right, to do the recycling because the fuel is so efficient. It's like some of the reasons we don't solve the challenges is because of the nature of the technology. So that the recycling is a combination of an economic and political choice, right? There are plenty of solutions for waste. Many of them are bogged down in politics. It's also a little bit of I don't want to say a values choice, but there is no one wants to deal with it. And so in part because the waste is pretty safe where it is, it's actually quite safe where it is. Like, the problem doesn't have any urgency. So some of why we don't solve nuclear waste is there's no urgency. The configuration of keeping the fuel in casks on site right now, it's never hurt anyone. The timeline until it might hurt anyone is quite long. So there isn't a forcing function to solve the problem. It's not that it's not solvable.
Political terms of 4 years, something like this.
Yeah, it's the president 10 years from now problem. And the utilities, right? So the U.S. government was supposed to start receiving nuclear waste and taking care of it in 1998. So the government has been in breach of contract since 1998. the utilities used to pay for waste disposal. So one of the other, you know, interesting things about nuclear is they have been paying for disposal of the waste since it started being generated, which no other fuel source has done, by the way. They're not paying that fee anymore because the government has been in breach of contract since 1998. And so now the government pays the utilities for the cost of keeping the waste because they're breaking their contract. So like the utilities kind of don't care.
There's just no there's push. Just like,
yeah, there's nobody to break the logjam, which is too bad.
Right. Well, but nonetheless, there are advances taking place, right? So as far as I understand, now is a fairly exciting time for developments in nuclear. So let's jump onto that. I know that we only have about 10 more minutes or so. So what are advanced reactors?
Yeah, well, I didn't finish your question on economics of why new plants aren't getting built. And that is, again, it depends. So like I said, Vogtle, the one that we've built so far in the United States, has been very expensive. Vogtle 2, some good progress. Is anybody going to take on the sort of social risk of building another one? I don't know. We'll see. Other countries are building nuclear reactors because they can do it on time and on budget. So they are being built other places, just to make that clear. And then these advanced reactors that let's talk about, the economics are speculative. And it's likely that the first few are going to be expensive because we haven't built them yet. And the first time, the first couple of times, the first of a kind of something, it's more expensive. And so my hope is that we have the political will to build a few so that we get to that, the fourth and the fifth one where the cost is stable. And that's when I think it becomes a really valuable tool. Okay, so hopefully that answered that a little bit more thoroughly.
Can I just ask something quickly on that note? I thought China had already begun either with a thorium reactor, or I thought they had at least one advanced reactor that was online.
They do. We don't collaborate with the Chinese on nuclear technology.
I see. So we don't have, but surely they have publications and they have information coming out about the costs, and or is that not open?
So it's not reliable.
Right.
So there are cost numbers about all types of Chinese reactors, but we don't know how real those numbers are.
Right.
So it's difficult
so that we don't get don't get lost. What is an advanced reactor? So before we jump into what's actually happening, what do you classify as an advanced reactor, and how do they differ from the more traditional variety?
Yeah. So part of this complexity of the conversation, advanced reactor is a very large bin. So it means we're using a non-water coolant, so anything except for water, to remove the heat. And some people also mean reactors that are small and modular. So there are light water is just regular water. It's to distinguish it from heavy water, which is water with made out of deuterium, and the Canadians use it. So light water reactors are just regular water. Heavy water reactors also kind of existing. So we can have small modular reactors that use still water cooling, and some people consider those advanced. That's like NuScale or the BWRX-300. And then we have reactors that use a different type of coolant and a different type of fuel. And those are very certainly advanced reactors. And some of those are small and some of those are large.
And thorium reactors. So this is, people throw around this word a lot. What does it mean? What are these reactors and why are they special?
Yeah. So most reactors are using uranium as the primary fuel, typically uranium-235, or for fast reactors, recycled material. For thorium reactors, they're using thorium for the fuel. And so thorium is interesting in that it is more abundant than uranium. There's not a uranium shortage. So, how much do we care about that at this moment? Not that much. It's also distributed differently. So some countries have abundant thorium reserves, notably India. And so those countries might be particularly interested because of domestic resources. It is more difficult to have There are some concerns about thorium that are lower. It is more difficult to fabricate the fuel. We overall don't have that much experience with it, so that is a factor. And then it is a little bit more intensely radioactive while it's operating, so the operating radiation environment can be a little bit higher. So there are some trade-offs. I know that like the thorium reactor Reddit community is pretty enthusiastic. I'm not expecting thorium reactors to play a dominant role anytime soon.
And why is that specifically? What makes uranium better than thorium? If it is, for instance, in India where it's plentiful, what makes the economics or the technical difficulties not worth it?
Yeah, it's just easier to make the fission happen. Mm-hmm. So it's easier to make the reaction go. It's easier to fabricate the fuel. And at this point, we just have a lot more experience with it. So in terms of simulation codes, materials, engineers, just sort of like the whole design piece, we have more familiarity and experience with uranium. And that's a big deal when you're making something new.
I heard one of the pluses with thorium also is that at the back end, so when you have the waste coming out, that waste is less problematic. Is that the case?
I think so. I am not an expert in thorium. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if thorium reactors go gangbusters, like, great. I actually, when maybe 10 or 15 years ago, India started having more cooperation agreements with a lot of the rest of the world on nuclear technology. And I was really hoping we were going to get thorium reactors, but so far that hasn't gone anywhere.
Hmm. And so these small modular reactors, what has changed in the recent past which has allowed for this technology? What's the new thing that allows these to come online today?
Yeah, there's some improvement in computation and material science. So that's some of it. A lot of it is just demand interest, the focus on clean energy, the need for clean firm power, the anticipated load growth. It's not so much because we've built almost all of these types of reactors before, some of them experimentally, some of them commercially. But sodium fast reactors, that's one category. We've had experiments in the United States. They've operated commercially in France. Gas cooled reactors, we've operated them commercially here and in the UK. Molten salt reactor, that one we just had an experiment, a little less experience there. Lead reactor. The Russians have the most experience with lead reactors. So there have been all of these kinds before, but the renewed focus is really on, we need nuclear energy. We need clean, firm power. This might be a pathway to more reliably low cost, especially in economies that are bad at mega projects. And we can probably design them more effectively because of improvements in material science and computation.
So then what does the future of nuclear energy look like, right? Are we going to see a revolution sort of in the same way that we saw electric cars being developed? Where are we?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know. I do think for countries that have large load growth and are good at mega projects, they're going to keep building large light water reactors. If you need to grow your electricity at like gigawatt chunks, and you can build large projects, I think they're going to build the AP1000 type reactor. Those are the new ones with stronger safety parameters. For countries like the US and Western Europe, we'll see if over the next decade we get ourselves together to actually build a few of these and get the workforce and the experience to have enough to come down the cost curve. And then maybe we do deploy them. To be honest, I was a little less confident in how this was going to go until the sheer sucking noise of electricity need from AI and data centers. I don't think there's a choice. I think we have to figure out reactors, and maybe that's advanced reactors. Maybe we just decide to build more LWRs. I don't know. But if you talk to Amazon and Meta and Google and Microsoft, they do not know how they're going to get enough clean electricity.
So then if your ideal rollout happened, if your dream scenario occurred, This is the last question, by the way, because I know, being respectful of your time, we have to wrap up. So in your dream world scenario, how much of the world could we power, for how long, and what would the impact be on the environment if we could roll out nuclear as you would see it?
Yeah, I mean, the potential is very large, especially if you recycle. I mean, if you recycle, you can kind of, you have a lot of electricity for a really long time. My dream scenario is that it makes up a reasonable part of the electricity base. I don't think we should not use these other clean energy technologies. I'm excited about the potential of geothermal. I'm delighted that wind and solar keep, you know, improving. I'm happy that long duration storage is coming online, or starting to become of not coming online, but you know, these technologies are getting developed. I just, over relying on any one technology type is not a great idea. So having, I am the, maybe this is a little cliche, I'm all of the above minus fossil, right? There's reasons where different technologies are better suited to different areas. Different technologies are better suited to different purposes. Right. If you have a heavy industrial base with pretty, that needs very constant electricity supply, nuclear is a great choice.
But so what is the impact if you go the no nuclear route, or you go what we might call the sensible nuclear route? What's the outcome environmentally? Do you have a picture of that?
So I think, I mean, this is where maybe people are going to get upset at me. It's lower if you have nuclear power. Right. You just need less stuff. There's less material. There's less land use. There's less mining. Like, the whole circle of impacts that I think we don't always think about. Nuclear just is very low impact. And the waste is a thing that people really worry about. And that can be managed. And it can be managed even better than we're managing it today, where today it's like fine, but it's not a long term solution. There are a collection of long term solutions. But you just need less stuff. And if you recycle, you need way less stuff.
Well, Rachel Slabaugh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.